Today's operation is the frustration of Vietnam in miniature.
I shall not see.
The worst area we've been in since I've been in Vietnam. Awful sick, and I'll be so glad to go home.
And I will not accept.
As men clamored over one another, pushing aside women and children in their panic-stricken fury, members of the air crew dragged them onto the plane, trying to fill it as fast as possible.
The nomination of my party for another term as your president.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate.
This is Dr. Stephen Nurse. These episodes of Is Abled focus on the brave men and women who fought in the Vietnam War, not the politics that surrounded the war. This is The War in Vietnam, Part 2. Those who were there are still fighting because the jungle changes a man. Hello, this is Dr. Stephen Nurse, and this is our series on the war in Vietnam. And we are interviewing today another Vietnam veteran. This is really important to get these personal stories. His name is Joe Robertson. He happens to be the father of the young man, that fine young man that my daughter is dating in the San Francisco area. And when she came up to visit me this weekend, or last weekend, Jay mentioned that his father was a Vietnam vet. So I jumped on that, and we've tried to get people from in all different areas. You know, one of the things that I think was kind of interesting is that they say in the war in Vietnam that it for every person that was out there stomping around in boots in the rice paddies, that there were 23 people that provided support services. And I think that's one of the things, Joe, this is one of the things that kind of amazes me about the war, is that if you think that at one time after Tet that they increased the number of soldiers by 225,000. And if you just think about the logistics behind that, that's like a big city. You know, you're moving across the ocean. But so tell me, when you you said that you were 21 years old when you went in, and and you were drafted. And the important thing is, I think that I want to talk about is you were a conscientious objector. And tell me a little bit about that.
So the selective service system, together with the military, had a classification of soldiers who, for a variety of reasons, often religious and sometimes not, who were opposed to killing other people. Especially in war, which is in a form of political activity. And so I had to convince the selective service system that I was genuinely opposed to participating in armed combat.
And I have to really think, you know, I guess that's one of the things that's always kind of stuck in my craw about war, is that you've got a conflict where whichever side kills the most people wins. That doesn't seem like much of a win for me, you know. And
right.
So your folks were opposed to this too then?
Yes. My mom was active in the anti-war movement. Which it still strikes me as somewhat odd that a blue-collar government worker up in the woods of the Sierra Nevada mountains would be involved in a movement like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But it says a lot about my mother. My father was a decorated Marine in World War II, and no one is more patriotic than him, but he considered the Vietnam War folly.
And that's, you mentioned, I know in the stuff you sent to me that both your folks said that they would move to Canada if that helped you get out of the Army. Is that correct?
That is correct. You know, both of them were career state government workers, and all of their family was in California, and that just didn't matter.
Yeah.
They made the offer and said they'd give all that up. And I came to the decision that I wasn't going to do that to my parents and my sister. I was just going to hope for the best.
And so you went ahead and where did you do your, basic training there in California?
No, at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas.
That's kind of like the government. You know, you live in a state and they send you to another state to train, right? But
that's on purpose.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Because they don't want you going home and...
That's right. They don't want you to go home.
And
so they take you far away.
Yeah. I guess that makes some sense if you really, you know, if you look at the concept of basic training, you know, you're kind of supposed to, as I understand it, kind of throw everything out the window and, you know, respond to a command. And that makes sense. And so you said you flew into Vietnam on a one-hour flight. Oh, no, that's when you're in Vietnam. To your out to your air cavalry base, and
right.
So what was your first thought of Vietnam when you landed there?
As we were landing, the pilot of the contract airliner came on the intercom and said there were some rocket attacks at the airport a little while ago, but everything seems quiet now, so we should be all right. But leave the plane promptly.
Uh-huh. That's a lot worse thing to say in it other than last round for drinks, you know.
Yeah.
But
No, we were on our way to Vietnam, so no, drinks were not an option.
Yeah, I'm sure that's probably true. In fact, I've had two other vets say the same thing. One of them is a guy I graduated with in high school, and he was saying that that as the plane landed, there were, you know, mortar rounds, you know, hitting around them, and he asked the guy in front of him, where are we running to? And the guy says, I don't know, but we're running away from that. And I also had a group of a woman who was one of the donut dollies who said that they landed when they landed there, they were all dressed up in high heels and everything, and they're running across the tarmac, you know, trying to get out of everything there. So a lot of inconsistencies. So then tell me what it was like where you were based out there in the one-hour flight from Saigon.
So we were northwest of Saigon, between Saigon and the Cambodian border, and there was some farmland, very little, because a lot of that area had been pacified. So they relocated all the citizens into cities where they were safer and they also could be controlled. And
sure.
Then all the land surrounding the bases and the towns where we were was set aside just for war. Nothing else was going on out there.
And so were those areas areas that were also sprayed with Agent Orange, that kind of thing?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
A lot of it had been sprayed with Agent Orange. And they did allow loggers to go out and cut firewood and cut down trees for lumber during the daytime out there.
And you said that you did not carry an arm or carry until you got an old carbine that was, what did it, tell me about that.
Oh, we, shortly before the Cambodian invasion, we came across a bunker complex with a lot of old weapons. And one of the weapons that we found was an M2 carbine from late World War II or the Korean War.
That's a big, heavy gun.
No, it was small. It was it was the small version of those.
Oh, okay.
And so we carried all the weapons away from there and blew up all the ammunition that we found. But then eventually that, as soon as we got somewhere to fly all that stuff out, our platoon leader had that weapon put in with his stuff back at the division headquarters. And then when we were going into Cambodia, and my platoon leader had become a company commander at of a different company, and he knew it was going to be a big deal. And he said, "I insist that you take a weapon with you."
And okay.
I said, "Okay, sure." But then, as it turned out, whenever there was shooting going on, I was too busy being a medic to have any need, and I never had any need to fire that weapon.
Did you? So you never fired the weapon, but you were basically repairing people that had been shot, correct?
Correct.
And you were shot. You were shot once yourself, too, correct?
Yeah, twice.
So you have two Purple Hearts.
No, just one, because it was at the same time by the same person.
Oh, okay, I gotcha. And tell me a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, when I tell this story to people, I start with, in our basic training, and the drill sergeants, who many of them thought we were slightly weak in the head for being conscientious objectors, they wanted to tell us things that they thought would help us survive. And one of the things they told us every day was, when someone says medic, you say, "Bring them here. Don't run out there where they just got shot, because you will get shot." So,
which kind of makes sense. I mean,
it does make sense.
Yeah.
From a purely business point of view, you know, take care of your precious resources. Well, our company, we were on our way to an enormous North Vietnamese weapons and electronics cache in Cambodia, and the North Vietnamese Army knew where we were going. They knew where it was, and the colonel's plan was that we would go, and whenever they resisted us the most, that meant we were going in the right direction. So one evening we had contact with enemy, and a couple guys were wounded, and they knew that we would fly them out from a clearing the next morning. That's what we always did.
Sure.
And so we went straight to the next clearing, and shortly after the company arrived, the company was ambushed by a significantly larger force that was hidden in the tree line. And so I was tending to wounded people, and someone said, "Need a medic over on the left side." And so I went running right over there, contrary to what I'd been told every day for 16 weeks. And there was a medic who'd been shot through the leg and leaned up against a tree, and a squad leader and his radio operator, and they both had minor wounds. So I started to work on the medic, and a bullet passed through my forearm from my left, and I turned and grabbed a dressing out of my ammo can that I carried all my bandages and medications and stuff
sure.
in. And a third medic showed up. And I said, Tennessee, tie this on my arm and we'll go back to work on Doug, the first medic. And he was just getting ready to tie that dressing on my arm when a bullet passed through the squad leader's butt, my left arm, and Tennessee's hip. And it occurred to me that the tree was not helping. The tree was was not stopping those bullets because they were coming from a different direction. So I grabbed all my stuff and moved about 10 feet where I was under a big bush. And
this seems really clear to you, like you can just see this right now.
Oh, yeah. I picture it perfectly. 50 and a half years later.
Wow.
I got out another dressing. One of the infantrymen came up, and I told him, tie this around my arm as tight as you can get it, right here, and I pointed. And it had severed the brachial artery, and blood was squirting out of my arm. And I knew I would go into shock, so I drank a quart of water and took some salt tablets. And then I did start to go into shock, and they moved me to a safe area where they were collecting wounded on the edge of the clearing. And our the first round fired against our company was a rocket-propelled grenade that landed at the command post where the captain and the artillery observer and the medics and radio operators all were, and all of them were wounded, and they all just kept working. So the field observer or the forward observer called in artillery, and there was just artillery landing in a circle all the way around us for what seemed like quite a long time to me. And when he stopped and the artillery stopped, it was quiet out there. There was nothing out there.
It's one of the things that I've heard from some of the other vets, and particularly one of my friends who I went to school with, was wounded with a booby trap and got a lot of shrapnel in his leg. And he said at the time he was on just automatic and he didn't even feel the pain in his leg. Is that your experience? I can't imagine it not hurting, but I mean, how was that?
The way I've described it is the first round that struck my forearm felt like someone had hit my arm with a hammer, and from the impact.
Yeah.
The second round that was close to the bone in my upper arm, it was really close to one of the nerves. And so it, as doctors would say, it insulted the nerve. And so it felt like I had taken a pair of pliers and clamped them between my thumb and forefinger.
Wow.
And that persisted for days. But it was just pain. You know, it wasn't disabling.
Right.
It was just there.
Yeah. You mentioned one of the. You mentioned that one of the most frustrating periods when you were here was when the you were trying to help a person and he was too far gone to be helped.
Yes.
Do you mind talking about that? I mean, I think people need to hear these kinds of stories.
He was the captain, the company commander, and he was drafted in the Army, but they give everyone placement tests, essentially, and they discovered that he would likely be a good officer, and as it turned out, they sent him to training, and he became an officer, and he was an excellent officer. And so when I first came to the company, I was an extra medic. So I spent all my days with the company medic who accompanied the company commander. And I talked to the company commander quite a lot, you know, in the evening when we're
having dinner and that kind of stuff, yeah.
Having dinner and whatnot out of a can.
Yes.
And so we got to know each other, and shortly after we got into Cambodia, the company had stopped for a resupply, I believe. And he looked over and saw some enemy soldiers. And instead of directing people where to go, he led people there. And one of those enemy soldiers threw out a grenade. And as I pointed out to you earlier, when we removed his shirt, we saw that he had about 2 dozen holes in his chest in the front, and a dozen of them had come out the back.
Oh.
So no matter what, his prospects were not good. And we tried starting IVs, but it was, they're just
too much blood.
Losing too much blood loss, and we couldn't do enough to save it.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was someone that I had a tremendous amount of respect for.
That's got to make it even harder.
It does, and I was upset when I got shot because I felt that I was being a good medic, but I wasn't being a good soldier, and I wasn't paying attention to where the rifle fire was coming from, and I got myself shot by not being more aware of all the gunfire. And
it's interesting. I was just going to say, it's interesting how we, as humans, sometimes blame things on ourselves we really don't have a whole lot of control over.
Exactly. And I was upset at him briefly because he was doing something, you know, and it was a heroic thing what he did, but it got him killed. And I resented that.
Wow.
Even though, you know, he was an excellent soldier, and leaders like that don't lightly send people to get shot.
Yeah.
I mean, they really consider all the possibilities and the consequences of what they do.
Yeah. I've got a couple more questions for you. Have you been to the wall?
I have.
And how did you feel about that? I mean, did you look for his name or did you?
Yes. I think 6 of the guys in our company were killed while we were in Cambodia out of 100. Almost half of the company of 110 was wounded. But by its very design, the wall you can go right to the name of the person you're looking for and find their name. And you can touch it. But there are so many names on the wall, and it tapers off into the distance in both directions. And it really reinforces the enormity of what happened in Vietnam.
You know, I've been there myself, and I know there was a great deal of controversy about, well, first of all, the fact that I think a Vietnamese woman did the, Maya Lin did the development of that. But my impression when I saw it, it was beautiful yet stark. It was, when you realize what it was, I really like the way that, you know, you start at one end with the, as it tapers up to the 68, you know, kind of in that area when
Yes. There
were a lot more people killed. And I thought it was really, really impressive, and I thought it was really a great tribute. I mean, you don't want people to die for a tribute, but so would you say, I know the Everly Brothers said, one of the Everly Brothers said about being a Marine, they went, they said that if they were asked if they wanted, if they were glad they went to Vietnam, and they said, you know, I wouldn't have gone for $1 million, but I wouldn't have also given up the experience for $1 million. How do you feel about your experience there? Are you glad you did it? Do you wish you hadn't? What's your feeling?
No, I'm not glad I did it.
Right.
Even though I gained from being there, there's a group of about 25 people that in many ways are closer to me than anyone else in the world.
Yeah.
People that would give their life for me.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, that's a true friend. To say that, Joe, to be able to save that is worth $1 million.
It is.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to meeting you. And as I said in one of my correspondences, if you ever get up this way, you're welcome in my house anytime. And
thank you.
I hope we do get to see each other. I know when we get down there, we're going to do that. So,
all right, that'll be great.
Well, we've run out of time here, and I can't tell you how much this means to me, just, you know, to do this. So thank you very much, Joe. I'll be in contact with you. You take care and have a good day, and again, appreciate your story.
But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
April 30th, 1975 was the official end of the war in Vietnam. But to say it was the end of the war would not be giving all those who participated their earned respect. The collateral damage continues and causes suffering to this day. Dr. Steve Nurse, signing off.